And now I get the privilege also to introduce Brian Grimm, who's a senior researcher in religion and world affairs and director of cross-national data at the Pew Research Center's Forum on Religion and Public Life. He is an expert on global religious restrictions and hostilities, as well as international religious demography. Brian also plays a central role in writing reports and providing information to policymakers, news organizations, and others interested in religion and world affairs. And obviously, in the light of the recent Pew reports, this makes him quite fascinating for our discussion here today. However, Brian has also worked as an educator, a researcher, a development coordinator in the former Soviet Union, China, Central Asia, the Middle East, and Europe before joining the Pew Center in 2006. I was lucky enough to be at dinner with Brian yesterday to hear some of these stories from his life about bringing up his kids in these environments as well. And I was talking to his wife, Julie Beth, as well, about a book she is writing. And I'm afraid I'm going to give a shameless plug for it now because it sounds fascinating. I understand that there was a little conflict over the title, but Naz and I think, are hoping to be able to claim a part in coming to a solution on this and combining the two proposed titles to create a working title of Naked Light Bulbs, The Definitive Guide to Raising Children, which I think you'll agree sets something up in that book. Now, I understand this wasn't a religious conflict, obviously, but in terms of conflict resolution, there we go. That's that work in action. So Brian himself received a doctorate in sociology from the Pennsylvania State University. He's the author of The Price of Freedom Denied, published by Cambridge University Press, The World Religion Database, published by Brill, The World's Religions in Figures, published by Wiley-Blackwell, as well as reports on religion in China, the future of the global Muslim population, and the forum's global restrictions on religion studies. Brian has also appeared as an expert on global religion on numerous media outlets, including CNN, the BBC, Fox, CBS, C-SPAN, and regularly presents to high-level audiences, including the White House, State Department, European Parliament, and the UN Human Rights Council. And he indeed recently joined the esteemed TED community, of which we are about to reap the full benefit, I believe. So without any further introduction, though that was quite one hell of an introduction, I think you'll agree, I'll give the floor over to Brian.
Well, this debate over the title of her book was really a decade in the making, and so it was solved last night, it sounds like. So I think McGill has a great future for conflict resolution, applying these principles. Well, as the introduction noted, I am an academic, I'm not an advocate, I'm not a diplomat, so that's the angle with which I approach this topic. It's informed by my experiences, having lived and worked and raised a family with my wife overseas for 20 years in many places. And that informs the study that I do. So, for instance, in China, when we arrived in 1982, we sailed up the China coast by boat. And when we landed in China, we had no idea whether religion had survived the Cultural Revolution that sought to destroy all religion. All religion was shut down, practice was forbidden in China. But to our surprise, and I think everyone's surprise, religion not only survived but grew behind what was then called the bamboo curtain. Today, China has the largest, half of the world's Buddhists today live in China. It has the largest population of people who practice folk religion of any country in the world. It has the seventh largest population of Christians of any country in the world. It has the 17th largest population of Muslims. It falls in rank right after number 16, Saudi Arabia, and number 8, and before number 18, Yemen. Religion is a big issue in China today. Another point in our journey of naked light bulbs was the Soviet Union. In 1989, I was on my way to the Soviet Union where I was doing cultural and education exchanges in Kazakhstan. And on the way, my plane stopped in Berlin, and I was going to transfer to East Berlin and catch a flight from there into the Soviet Union. And my friend who was traveling with me met me in Berlin, and he ran up and he said, "Did you hear?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "Right now." And we jumped in the car. We drove as fast as we could to the Berlin Wall, and we were part of those crowds pulling it down. And the next day, we walked through the Berlin Wall. The only two people we knew that were walking that way, tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of people were flooding into West Berlin to taste a new sense of freedom. And that freedom involved a new day of openness towards religion. That same trip, when I went to Almaty, Kazakhstan, which was then the capital of the Soviet Socialist Republic of Kazakhstan, I had a meeting with the Minister of Education, and we sat in one of these long, and you'll know these kinds of rooms, long tables and portraits of Lenin and Marx and other folks on the wall. And I was sitting right under the portraits of Lenin and Marx, and the Minister of Education said, "Well, you know who the most important philosopher in the history of the world is?" And I looked up behind me, and he said, "Jesus Christ." And I thought, boy, I'm not in China. It was amazing to see religion come back into the public discussion. That was during Glasnost, but things moved very rapidly in the Soviet Union. Now, most Russians identify with the Orthodox Church. There's a very large Muslim population and other minority faiths in Russia growing. And then another stop on our journey was in the Middle East. So on September 11th, 2001, I was teaching in a city where there were 20,000 Taliban working. And that day, and the attacks of those days and the events that followed, forever changed the way that I looked at the issue of religious freedom and how I studied it. Up to that point, the paradigm was mostly defined by communist governments and the restrictions coming from governments. But the attacks of 9/11 made clear that the actions of even just a few individuals and small groups can have a direct and powerful impact, perhaps even more powerful than governments, on the context in which religion is understood and religious freedom then has to negotiate this new territory. So that led me on a course to try to measure these things, to measure these two ways of looking at religious freedom and how it's restricted, coming both from governments, but also from groups and individuals and societies. So this new way of looking at religious freedom has given a new type of language, and I think that's one thing that's useful to diplomats in negotiating this terrain of religion and not promoting religion, not being negative to religion, but being someone level about religion. It's just a normal human factor. So creating measures that can concretely objectivize these religious dynamics in the world is now catching on. I was just in the UN Human Rights Council a couple months ago, and we were looking at how the data that I'm going to share with you today was part of a discussion of the potential prevention of mass atrocities and genocide. So it has some utility. So, but first, what is the context? So Ambassador Seipel mentioned a statistic that 84% of the world's population is affiliated with one religion or another, and that comes from one of our studies. But even among the 16% of people who don't attach themselves to a specific religion, many of them still have religious beliefs or practices. So because religion is so important to many people in the world, it's important to know how free people are to make a personal choice about what religion to have, about whether to change their religion, or even whether to have a religion at all. But measuring religious freedom is very difficult, because how can you measure how free someone is? So I look at the inverse. I look at restrictions on religion coming both, as I've mentioned, from governments and from groups in society. The findings of the study show that about 40% of the world's countries have high or very high restrictions on religion or religious hostilities. But because several of these countries are very populous, about 3/4 of the world's population, or 5.1 billion people, live in countries with high or very high restrictions. Again, most of these are often felt by the religious minorities in these countries. The findings of this study are based on a careful analysis of 198 countries and territories around the world through research I do at the Pew Research Center. We carefully look at the constitutions and laws of each of these countries, as well as human rights reports coming from organizations such as the U.S. State Department, the United Nations, the U.K. Foreign Office, the United Nations. And we read each of these reports, and we carefully count up and categorize each government restriction on religion and each social hostility involving religion, and then add them up into indexes in a way that we can compare the situation in one country versus another. I'll talk more about these indexes as I go on, but first I should mention that our research is more like a thermometer than a predictive tool. We're at the Pew Research Center, we're just trying to get the lay of the land and provide information that's useful to people. So rather than suggesting a cure or advocating for what the response should be, today I'm just trying to give you an understanding of the lay of the land, and perhaps that will start discussions and responses to the situation in the world. So, but first, what's a government restriction on religion, and what's a social hostility involving religion? I'll give examples from two countries. First, Pakistan. In Pakistan, blasphemy, that's saying or doing something considered by others to be critical of God, is an offense that carries the death penalty. That means you can be put to death for saying or doing something considered critical of God. So that's a government restriction on religion. But recently, when two prominent Pakistani politicians were assassinated because they merely suggested that this law should be rethought, that's a social hostility involving religion. In Indonesia, Ahmadiyya Muslims believe that a prophet came after Muhammad. In Indonesia and several other Muslim-majority countries, they're considered heretics. The government has classified them as unorthodox and has confined all of their religious practice to just their buildings. They can't display their faith, they can't proclaim their faith, they can't share their faith with anyone else. In other words, their religion is only trapped within their own buildings and with the hope that it dies. Well, that's a government restriction. But in response to some of these restrictions, mobs have attacked Ahmadiyya Muslims. They've burned down their mosques, killed them. You can even find some of these videos of them beating Ahmadiyyas to death on the internet. Well, those are social hostilities involving religion. So let's look a little bit now at government restrictions in particular. Our study looks at 20 different ways that governments can restrict the free practice of religion, and then again adds them up into indexes. So the more ways that a government restricts religion, the higher your score. And we find that about two-thirds of the world's population live in countries with high or very high government restrictions. So in addition to the examples I've already given, some of the other types of government restrictions we monitor include whether or not the government limits what you can wear, so religious symbols you can wear. We find that about in more than a quarter of countries worldwide, governments limit the wearing of religious symbols. For instance, recently in England, a woman was fired from her job, a public service job, merely because she wore a very small Christian cross around her neck for display. That case went to the European Court of Human Rights, and they found that British law did not adequately protect an individual's right to have a display of their faith while at work. It wasn't a safety hazard. We also find that in about a third of countries worldwide, people are imprisoned for their religion-related activities. So, for instance, in Burma, Buddhist monks continue to languish in prison cells for their role as clergy in promoting human rights and democracy. Also, in about a quarter of countries worldwide, governments limit conversion. Sometimes this is at the national level, or it can also be at the subnational level. In India, for instance, seven of its 28 states have anti-conversion laws. So these laws are intended to prevent, for instance, missionaries or someone paying someone to convert. Well, that sounds like a reasonable thing. You shouldn't pay someone to convert. But in practice, these laws are often used to accuse people falsely, and it leads to mob violence and even mass atrocities in certain states of India. So that's a government restriction that then has some connection to social hostilities. And I'll be speaking to that a bit more. Let's look at social hostilities and what I mean by social hostilities. We look at 13 different types of social hostilities, whether they're present in a country or not, and the degree to which they're present. So if they're present and present in the higher degree, then the country gets a higher score on the social hostilities index. We find that in about half the world's countries, half the world's people live in countries with high or very high social hostilities involving religion. In addition to the ones I've mentioned already, these include sectarian violence, which occurs in 1 in 7 countries worldwide. So in Iraq, for instance, on an almost daily basis, you can continue to read stories of people being killed in acts of sectarian violence and even large-scale violence in Iraq today, even though the civil war ended several years ago. This violence continues. In more than a third of countries worldwide, religion-related terrorist groups are active. This is a statistic sometimes I'll ask, well, how many, you know, I won't put you on the spot today, but I ask people, how many countries would you say this is happening? Oh, 5%, 6%. But we find religion-related terrorist groups active in more than a third of countries worldwide. Recently, in an act of religion-related terror, a Jewish rabbi and 3 Jewish school children were gunned down in France. We saw recently in Boston bombs set off that killed several and injured many hundreds in an act that was religion-related. Just a few weeks ago, a British soldier was attacked and stabbed to death on a street in Britain in a religion-related act of terror. And this is shifting just not from groups, but even from individuals who are acting out radical tendencies in society. We also find that in a third of countries worldwide, individuals or groups enforce religious norms with violence or the threat of violence. In Indonesia, as was mentioned earlier, that there are five large religions that are promoted or acknowledged in the country, but people cannot not have a religion. You're required in Indonesia to have a religion. Atheism is illegal. This young man, his name just jumped out of my head, Alexander An, he was a Muslim and he decided that he would just give up on it. He was tired of having a faith, so he declared on an atheist blog site that he's an atheist. Right after that, mobs attacked him, drug him into the street. The police came to intervene to stop the violence. Instead of arresting the attackers, they arrested him for blasphemy, which is illegal in Indonesia, and he's serving a 2-year prison sentence in jail for blasphemy. So again, another connection between the laws and the social hostilities. One of the advantages of this type of work, which I realize is a bit different and speaking in a chapel about numbers, I think it's appropriate. There's a book in the Bible called Numbers, right? So, but one of the advantages of having these kind of figures is that we can see what these trends are doing over time. As I've mentioned already, about 40% of the world's countries have high religious restrictions or hostilities today. So what was the situation just a few years ago? Our study finds that it's markedly different. Just 4 years earlier, less than 30% of countries had high or very high religious restrictions or hostilities. So we're seeing that this is a rising trend, what we've called in our reports a rising tide of restrictions on religion. So now I'm going to give the most statistical chart of them all, and I'm going to give you a scatter plot. If you know what that is, then you're prepared. If you're not, then I'll try to ease you into it a little bit. Each dot on this chart represents a country. And I've plotted each country. There's 198 dots there. And each country is dotted on their government restriction score and social hostility score. So the further you are to the right, the higher your country's government restrictions are. Or the closer you are to the top, the higher the level of social hostilities. So one thing to notice, in 2007, the bottom left-hand corner of the chart was very populated. So a lot of countries had both low government restrictions and low social hostilities. But if we fast forward to 2011, that corner has thinned out. So more countries have moved up in their levels of government restrictions and social hostilities. Now, I'm going to take the 25 most populous countries from this chart and pull them out and then blow them up by their population size. So the bigger the bubble is, the bigger the population. So India on the top has the second largest population in the world, and China has the largest in the bottom right-hand corner. So there's several things to notice. Countries like Brazil, South Africa, Philippines, and Japan, which I don't think you can read, but these are countries in the bottom left-hand corner that have, relative to other countries that are very populous, lower levels of government restrictions and social hostilities. But there are four countries that are particularly of note up in the right-hand top right-hand corner because they're very high on both indexes. These countries are Pakistan, Russia, Indonesia, and Egypt. I've already mentioned Pakistan and Indonesia, but let's talk first a minute about Egypt. In Egypt, by government law, religious conversion is a one-way street. You can convert into Islam, but it's forbidden and against the law to convert out of Islam. In Russia, recently the mayor of Moscow made a ruling, and it's been approved by the council, that there can only be four mosques in all of Russia, in all of Moscow. And this is despite the population of Muslims more than doubling to more than a million people today, a million Muslims, and some estimate even a higher number. So if you can imagine all these 1 million Muslims in Moscow, if they all wanted to go to Friday prayers, that means a quarter of a million people had to squeeze into this place meant for just a few hundred. Now, one country on this chart stands out as what we call in social science an outlier. That's because it's the only country in that part of the chart. It's China, with very high government restrictions on religion, but relatively moderate social hostilities involving religion. So the Chinese, when I talk to them, to diplomats or academics or others, will say, well, this is proof that these high government restrictions are keeping social hostilities low. We don't want to be up, they don't want to be up in the top right-hand corner, they say. So this is proof. The data say something a little bit different. In 2007, China had low social hostilities involving religion, and then the Olympics happened in 2008, and there's been growing unrest among some religious communities in China, and they've moved up the chart. So this is a matter of concern, and one that that the Chinese are discussing, and I'll be at the Council on Foreign Relations sort of discussing these issues. You know, what would happen if China would just remove all government restrictions? Would they rise to the top right-hand corner of the chart, or would they pull back to the left-hand corner of the chart? I'm not sure I know the answer. These are, as other speakers have mentioned, these are complex issues that involve not just religion, but many other things as well. Our study also looks, groups countries into major regions of the world, and when we do this, one thing stands out. The Middle East and North Africa, on average, has higher government restrictions, so that's in the middle of the chart, higher government restrictions and higher social hostilities than other regions of the world. In 2011, the Arab Spring happened. What we saw in the lead up to Arab Spring was that social hostilities were at an elevated level, high level in the Middle East and North Africa, but they weren't increasing. But we saw a very marked tightening of government restrictions in the lead up to Arab Spring. So at the end of Arab Spring, which our latest report that just came out this week on Thursday did, we looked at what happened to the Middle East and North Africa. And it became even more of an outlier. So restrictions, government restrictions, and social hostilities both have increased in the region. So rather than the hope expressed by many, including President Obama and many other world leaders and people in the region, that Arab Spring would bring greater freedoms and more liberal policies in the region, the data so far up till this point don't show that that's been the result. Religious restriction, on the Middle East and North Africa, I can talk about some of the context in which these restrictions have risen. Our study, again, looks at 20 different kinds of government restrictions, and we treat government favoritism as a kind of restriction, where you favor one religion far and above others. So that makes an unlevel playing field. So this type of government restriction has the strongest association with social hostilities involving religion. When governments highly favor one religion above others, social hostilities are very high in those countries. So how does the Middle East or North Africa fare on this measure? Well, it's 8 times higher, has 8 times the level of government favoritism of one religion above others as in the rest of the world. So therefore, it's not so surprising that social hostilities are high. We also look at what types of social hostilities are most closely associated with government restrictions. And we find that one stands out above the rest, sectarian or communal violence. When this is present in a country, government restrictions tend to be very high. And again, the Middle East and North Africa has 4 times the level of sectarian or communal violence as other countries in the world. And we saw the number of countries during Arab Spring with sectarian or communal violence double. So again, that would suggest that if this correlation means something, that we wouldn't expect government restrictions to decline in such a period. One other thing our study looks at, or two other things that I'll mention. First is that we live in an interconnected world. Government restrictions on religion can reach far beyond national borders. In Saudi Arabia, there was a young journalist by the name of Hamza Kashgari, whose family originally came from northwest China, one of the places where 2 of our children were born, by the way. And he tweeted just some doubts about his faith on the Prophet Muhammad's birthday. Just from a Christian perspective, sort of a doubting Thomas kind of doubt. But those tweets were considered blasphemous, and calls for him to be brought up on charges of blasphemy were echoing, and he feared for his life because blasphemy is punishable by death in Saudi Arabia. So he got on an airplane and fled Saudi Arabia, hoping to seek asylum in Australia. But along the way, his plane stopped in Malaysia, and by that time, Saudi authorities issued an extradition request for him to be brought back to Saudi Arabia to face blasphemy charges. In Malaysia, the Malaysian government complied, put him on an airplane, and sent him back to prison where he's awaiting judgment. He could recant his blasphemy, change his ways, and save his life. But right now, he's in a jail in Saudi Arabia. One other thing that our study has looked at is the response of governments and societies around the world to this rising level of social hostilities and government restrictions on religion. Numerous international bodies, ranging from the United Nations to the European Parliament to the U.S. Congress, have been discussing these. I'll be giving a briefing on Thursday in the U.S. Congress. Part of the reaction is that we found that 3/4 of the world's countries have had some initiative to try to lower government restrictions or social hostilities involving religion. For instance, this year in February, the UN Alliance of Civilization meeting was held in Vienna, Austria. The Austrians made this rising tide of restrictions that I've talked about today a central theme of that conference that brought together world leaders and religious leaders to discuss what the response should be. This brought together leaders such as Imam Jega and Cardinal John from Nigeria, a country beset by many of the issues that we've talked about today. So 22 years ago, I was working in Kazakhstan with then the party secretary, Nursultan Nazarbayev, organizing cultural and educational exchanges. One day, out of the blue, my office building was taken over by the leaders of all the other Soviet socialist republics. They just came into the office building where I was working. We had a big round table room in that office building. And they met, and in my office building, they dissolved the Soviet Union. I had nothing to do with it that I know of. A few days later, the now President Nazarbayev I held a press conference with then Secretary of State James Baker, and at that press conference, he was asked, well, President Nazarbayev, will you give religious freedom to Kazakhstan now that you're an independent country? And he looked around the room and he pointed to some Muslims that were there and said, yes, we're going to give religious freedom for the Muslims. Then he looked over to some Orthodox and said, and to the Orthodox. And then he looked back at me and he said, and to the foreigners too. And I couldn't have imagined that 22 years later that I'd now be in a position to let still President Nazarbayev know how that's turned out in this country. Thank you.
Session go on any longer, but Brian's going to be around. Lunch is downstairs in the lobby where you met this morning, and I'm sure if you've got any questions, Brian will take them then. Thank you very much.